The Honorable, the Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit.
Our final case of the day is number 19-6523, Burke v. Clark. Mr. Harawa, you represent the plaintiff?
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning.
Good to have you with us.
And it's great to be with you virtually, Your Honor. And may it please the court, Daniel Scott Harawa on behalf of the appellant, Randy Burke. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honor, Randy Burke was forced to live in quasi-solitary confinement for over 4 years simply because he would not cut his hair, as that would violate his religion. Virginia Department of Corrections grooming policy and its confinement of Mr. Burke in the admittedly punitive violators housing unit place a substantial burden on Mr. Burke's religious practice in violation of RLUIPA and the First Amendment. On appeal, VDOC doesn't challenge the idea that the grooming policy and the VHU place a substantial burden on Mr. Burke's religious practice, and therefore they forfeit any argument in response. Instead, VDOC argues that Mr. Burke didn't raise his claim below, but that's just thoroughly belied by the record. So I'd point this court to JA 18, paragraph 36 of the complaint, where Mr. Burke specifically states that his placement in the VHU violated his First Amendment, RLUIPA, and Equal Protection Clause rights. I'd point this court to JA 23, paragraph 61 of his complaint, where Mr. Burke specifically stated that the grooming policy punished him for his religious beliefs in violation of the First Amendment, RLUIPA, and Equal Protection Clause rights. And then on JA 24, in his prayer for relief, Mr. Burke specifically requested a declaration that the application of the grooming policy as to him violated his religious rights in violation of RLUIPA, First Amendment, and the Equal Protection Clause.
Mr. Lara, this is Judge Diaz. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
So you pointed out in three separate instances in the complaint where he clearly alleges a violation of the grooming policy, but I understood the Commonwealth's argument to be that your client failed to exhaust his administrative remedies because he didn't mention the grooming policy when he filed his informal complaints or regular grievances, at least not the first set, and that works a waiver because of a failure to exhaust. So can you address that?
Your Honors, I think my reading of VDOC's brief is that it's not an exhaustion of administrative remedies in the prison that VDOC is alleging. Rather, it's an argument that Mr. Burke did not present this argument to the district court. And in fact, if you look at VDOC's brief, they say that because the magistrate judge didn't expressly address this argument, that he must not have raised this argument in the district court. So I don't think VDOC actually raised an administrative exhaustion type argument in regards to the argument.
They argue that Mr. Burke never made a challenge like this prior to the appeal, and therefore he failed to preserve the argument. I thought that was in the response brief. Am I misreading that?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. So the way I read the brief is that Virginia was arguing that he didn't raise this argument in the district court before he appealed his case to this court. Not that he didn't raise this.
Well, okay. So they didn't raise it. I suppose that's sort of, I think, at least an argument that that's a jurisdictional question as a prerequisite to our considering it. Let's assume for the moment that their argument is much more expansive. Do you concede that the first time that this grooming policy argument appears is in the complaint?
No, Your Honor, not at all. I think if you look at the grievances, which I'm turning to it now, if you look at page 107 of the joint appendix, so most of his grievances are listed from pages. I'm sorry, I'm just pulling it up, Your Honor. 97. 98, 99, 100, and he mentions the grooming policy numerous times throughout these grievances. He also mentions the religious policy, which requires housing in the violator's housing unit if you cannot comply with the grooming policy. So this is consistent throughout his grievances in the record. And in fact, the district court, when ruling on Mr. Burke's, or ruling on the defendant's summary judgment motion, the district court never held that Mr. Burke failed to exhaust his administrative remedies. Rather, the district court held that Mr. Burke, that this grooming policy and the VHU did not place a substantial burden on Mr. Burke's religious practice. So I don't think it's the case that this argument was not presented to the prison. And I think, in fact, Mr. Burke filed numerous grievances, as VDOC admits, regarding his housing in the VHU. He attaches numerous affidavits from other Rastafarian inmates who are housed in the VHU and how they're being punished for this. So this has always been the crux of Mr. Burke's claim from the very beginning on this case. And the fact that Virginia didn't argue this administrative remedy, exhaustion type argument, in fact, the district court didn't address this argument, I think shows that this argument is properly exhausted, and it was clearly raised in the district court below. And then the only other argument that VDOC makes in response to the First Amendment and LaLupa claim is that the claims are moot, but that's clearly that doesn't apply to the First Amendment claim, as that includes a request for damages. But Virginia also can't satisfy its heavy burden of meeting mootness in this situation, because as this court said in Wall v. Wade and Porter v. Clark, that when VDOC changes its policies during the course of litigation, where nothing prevents VDOC from going back to that policy, which is the case here, that this court won't find mootness, or won't find that VDOC met its burden of proving mootness. And so I think, given those clear precedents and their clear application here, it's clear that this case isn't moot. It's clear that Mr. Burke raised this argument in the district court, and therefore this court should review this argument on its merit.
And as to the merits, Judge Gallagher,
Judge Gallagher.
So you say that it's clear that he raised the arguments below, but the two separate judges that were reading the complaint and addressed the complaint and the decisions, neither one specifically interpreted his claims as including an impossible choice argument. Is that correct?
Well, Your Honor, I think Judge Kaiser's opinion is a little bit unclear on this point. But Judge Kaiser does say that Mr. Burke has produced evidence of a substantial burden on his religious practice. And Judge Kaiser, in his opinion, also discusses the VHU and how Mr. Burke is housed in the VHU because of his religious beliefs. So while I don't think the opinion is necessarily the most detailed as to that point, I do think Judge Kaiser recognized the substantial burden point when it denied VDOC's initial motion for summary judgment. Now, in the second motion for summary judgment, the magistrate judge did not address this argument. But that was in part because she found that, A, Mr. Burke's religious beliefs weren't sincere, an argument that VDOC refuses to press now. And then she said there just wasn't any kind of substantial burden on his exercise. But I think what is most telling as to this point is that when this court requested briefing in this case, it specifically acknowledged or asked for briefing on the question of whether this grooming policy and the VHU place a substantial burden on Mr. Burke's religious practice, which is completely consistent with this court's statement that its goal is to discern the intent of the litigant, and especially pro se litigants whose pleadings must be construed broadly. And it's clear from all of Mr. Burke's pleadings that he was saying he was being punished for his religious practice. The punishment in question was his housing in VHU and all of the restrictions that flowed from it. And so I do think, despite the district court's holding, I think a careful reading of Mr. Burke's pleadings, or even a cursory reading of Mr. Burke's pleadings, raises this argument squarely. And this court recognized that when it requested briefing on the argument. I'd like
Mr.
Yes, Your Honor.
Prior to you being assigned to the case by this court, did Mr. Burke ever have counsel in this case?
No, Your Honor. Mr. Burke never had counsel in the district court.
He was pro se all the time up to till you got in.
Yes,
Your Honor. You and your colleagues at the University of St. Louis.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. And then I'd like to turn to the Equal Protection Clause claim and explain why Mr. Burke, why it was inappropriate for the magistrate judge to grant summary judgment on this claim, especially after Judge Kaiser found that summary judgment was inappropriate. First, turning to the grooming policy, while the grooming policy is neutral on its face, an application had the effect of punishing Rastafarian inmates for practicing their religious beliefs. And we know, and we've seen time and again, that a neutral policy that targets a certain group of people can violate the Equal Protection Clause. And that's exactly what happened here. And in fact, Judge Kaiser, in his opinion, said that the BHU is reserved for inmates who refuse to cut their dreadlocks in violation of their religion. So Judge Kaiser understood the BHU as being home for Rastafarians who couldn't comply with the grooming policy. If this court looks or takes notice of Greenhill v. Clark, a prison official in that case said the BHU was reserved for Rastafarians. And then in an official VDOC policy paper, VDOC expressly notes that Rastafarians must comply with the grooming policy, despite the fact that numerous other religions could potentially be required to grow their hair or grow their beards in a way that would violate the policy. So it's clear that VDOC was targeting Rastafarians through the use of this grooming policy and their placement in the BHU. And this kind of differential treatment is only confirmed by the fact that Rastafarians just did not have the same opportunities to practice their religion as were given to other inmates in that prison. So, for example, there were no religious implements that Rastafarians could use to practice their religion, despite the fact that VDOC had available all kinds of implements for all sorts of religions, both that were donated, but also that VDOC carried for sale, and VDOC never housed or never carried any Rastafarian items.
So, can I ask a question about the policies you just talked about? Identified the Rastafarians as being impacted by the segregation policy. If that's the evidence that you have with respect to intent, which I guess you have to show for equal protection claim, isn't it more reasonable to read those policies as simply recognizing that the grooming policy had a discriminatory impact on Rastafarians, not necessarily that there was a discriminatory intent?
Your Honor, I don't think so, and that's for a couple of reasons. One is that the discriminatory impact operated just by the fact that the grooming policy was in existence, period. But the fact that VDOC specifically targeted Rastafarians on an official VDOC document saying that they, in fact, must follow the grooming policy shows that they intended for this grooming policy to, or at least the strong evidence that they intended for this grooming policy to apply to Rastafarians in ways that it did not apply for inmates of other religions. And then if you look at other aspects of the VDOC policy, so for example, JA-361, which is VDOC Operating Procedure 84, 1.3, which is the Offender Religious Programs document, it says that VDOC can restrict religious practice for failing to adhere to grooming requirements. And so the fact that VDOC knows that it is punishing people for not complying with the grooming policies, and then on top of that, the fact that VDOC specifically targets Rastafarians for compliance with the grooming policy, I think those two things together can give rise to an inference of discriminatory intent. And I think that's even more clear when you just look at the lack of resources available to Rastafarians in the prison to practice the religion in comparison with other religions in that prison. And so that goes not only to religious implements, it also goes to religious faith services. It goes to religious holidays and what meals and special services are available. And at every turn, Rastafarians received less than many of the other religions in the prison. And they're, on this record, VDOC has not produced any justification for why it treated Rastafarians so differently. And in fact, they only say that Mr. Burke never filled out the correct form, which if you look at the request to attend religious services form, there is no ability to request a Rastafarian religious service. And because Mr. Burke was in the phase one of the VHU, he actually wasn't eligible to attend group religious services. VDOC says Mr. Burke did not fill out the right form to request religious items, but if you look at JA-31, he did fill out an offender request form requesting the items, and VDOC never points to any other form that Mr. Burke should have filled out. And it's just VDOC cannot say that Mr. Burke never made the prison aware of the fact that he was just trying to practice his religion, and the fact that VDOC didn't have anything for Rastafarians to practice the religion in this prison, given all of the other implements it has, And given the fact that it has a sizable Rastafarian population, I think at this juncture should be enough to overcome summary judgment with regard to the question of intentional discrimination. And Your Honor, I see I'm coming up at the end of my 15 minutes, but I would just like to remind this court that Mr. Burke was literally placed in solitary confinement just because he wanted to practice his religion. And that this court looks at its decision in Porter v. Clark, where it discusses how death row inmates were housed in Virginia Department of Corrections facilities. The VHU operated exactly the same with the same kinds of restrictions as death row. And that's all because Mr. Burke grew his hair in accordance with his religion. And as the district court initially found before the magistrate judge issued her opinion, this was a place of substantial burden on Mr. Burke's religious practice. And he also, and summary judgment was also inappropriate on the Equal Protection Clause ground. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. We appreciate it. Ms. Samuels?
Yes, Your Honor.
You represent the defendants?
Yes.
Pleased to hear from you. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Jessica Samuels for the appellees. Mr. Burke's complaint in this case asserted two sets of claims that are before this court on appeal. One, violation of his rights to freely exercise his religious beliefs, and two, intentional discrimination in violation of the Equal Protection Clause. On the record presented below, the district court properly granted summary judgment on both sets of claims. This court should affirm that judgment for three reasons. First, the free exercise theory that counsel now presses on appeal was not raised below. Second, even if Mr. Burke had asserted a challenge to the grooming policy based on an impossible choice theory before the district court, that claim would now be moot. And third, the district court correctly concluded that the claims Mr. Burke did raise failed as a matter of law on the evidence presented. To begin with the free exercise claims, both the briefing and counsel's argument this morning make clear that the nature of these claims has shifted dramatically from what was before the district court. Throughout the proceedings below, Mr. Burke's pleadings consistently identified three ways in which he was allegedly not able to freely exercise his religious beliefs. One, group services, two, religious items, and three, holiday meals. Those are the issues that the department addressed in its summary judgment papers, and those are the issues that the district court addressed in its opinions. The grievances to which counsel points this morning were importantly not the ones that Mr. Burke chose to attach to his complaint. And that's important, Your Honors, because a plaintiff is the master of his complaint, even if pro se, and of all the grievances that Mr. Burke submitted and then appealed, which are in the record, as counsel noted, he chose certain of those grievances to attach to his complaint and to pursue in his federal court litigation. And the grievances—
I just want to be clear. I asked your friend on the other side this question, and it doesn't sound like you disagree with him, but this is not an appeal about exhaustion. It's an appeal about failing to plead in the district court. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Go ahead.
I think it's helpful to look at the complaint the way that my friend on the other side did this morning. We can start at the very beginning, which is JA 11. This is the form that Mr. Burke filed to initiate his lawsuit, the complaint form. And he clearly lays out separate claims, and his religious exercise claim says, defendants violated my rights to Rastafarian religious services, service items, and religious holy day meals. He's not challenging the grooming policy. He's not challenging the violator's housing unit. He's asking for access to three different items, three different things. And for the reasons we've explained, and I'm happy to discuss with the court this morning, nothing about those items that he's requesting impose a substantial burden on his free exercise of religion. As counsel notes, the point of the pro se standard is to discern the intent of a litigant. And looking at this pleading is the best way to do that, Your Honors. And when you read through the pleading, consistently, Mr. Burke is asking about services, items, and meals. That's the argument that the department addressed in its summary judgment papers. And that's the argument that both of the district court opinions considered. The timing here is also important, Your Honor, because the impossible choice theory that counsel now relies on, it wasn't new at the time, and it's not something that would have been foreign to the district court or to the department, because it was being litigated in the Greenhill case at exactly the same time. When you look at the way the procedural histories of these cases lined up, the Greenhill decision, the second opinion in that case, was in September of 2018, and the second opinion in this case was in March of 2019. And so the department was well aware of these arguments, and the district court...
So I'm looking at, again, looking at the pro se complaint, and you did correctly point out sort of the primary focus of the complaint. But Judge King pointed out, rightly so, that the plaintiff in this case was pro se up until the moment of this appeal. And so we do obviously take a pro se litigant and give him a fairly wide berth in terms of pleading and the like. I mean, he does throughout this complaint sort of identify that he's complaining about the defendants identifies the defendants in paragraphs 4 and 5 who are responsible for placing people in violator housing units for people who, quote, refuse to cut their hair because of Rastafarian religious beliefs. He does that at paragraph 4. He does it again in paragraph 6. And in paragraph 16 of the complaint, he says, at Red State Onion Prison, I was placed in segregation for not being in compliance with the Virginia Department of Corrections grooming standards because of my dreadlocks. I mean, and then in the legal claims, he talks about, he identifies the legal claims. Isn't that enough? I mean, we don't demand legal perfection of pro se litigants. It's clear that he's sprinkled this complaint throughout his pleading. Why isn't that enough?
Well, Your Honor, I think that the most important thing here is to remember that the special solicitude with which we construe pro se pleadings, which of course the department doesn't challenge here, but it does have a limit, and the limit is to discern the intent of what a litigant was challenging. And so to say that it was sprinkled throughout here enough, I think the appropriate lens to look at that through is what he was asking for. And he was asking for services, items, and meals. And I think JA-23, to which my friend on the other side points, is a helpful way to look at that, where the complaint notes that it does note the grooming policy, the operating procedure, but then he notes that the reason he's complaining about it is because it denies him access to group services, items, and meals. And so when you read through the complaint, those are the things he's asking for. And so I think that's the most helpful lens instead of are there enough references here or there. I think it's also helpful on that same note, Your Honor, that this is not a complaint where it's not clear what he's challenging or what he's seeking or where it's ambiguous and he invokes several different provisions and several different claims and the district court has to figure out what he's challenging. The department briefed summary judgment twice and the district court wrote two opinions, and Your Honor, to say now that the complaint adequately raised this claim, I think it would be fair to say that then the department and the district court just missed it. And so I think that that's a helpful understanding of what was and wasn't raised in terms of everyone who was looking at this pleading and trying to figure out what it said. On that same note, Your Honor, even if you don't agree with me and you think that is enough, I do think it's important to note that grooming policy that counsel has focused on this morning is no longer in effect, and so any injunctive claims on that would be moot. So to the extent this court is inclined to find that the grooming policy was adequately raised below and to remand on that basis, the prior policy that's been challenged, the claims on that would be moot, and so we would urge the court to at least agree with us on the mootness argument and send it back on a limited basis. But again, we don't concede that. We think it's not raised, and we don't think it's fair to...
This Judge King, your friend there on the other side says it's not moot because you can change it back tomorrow the way it was before. So we need to rule on it. He doesn't buy into your mootness claim.
Yes, Your Honor. We have several responses to that. The first is that this change in policy was not just an overnight flip of the switch. And the department adopted an entirely new department-wide policy that involves rigorous procedures and is not something that can change overnight. I think that's the first important fact on the mootness analysis. The second
Has he been moved out of the solitary confinement?
He's been moved out of the violator's housing unit. Yes, Your Honor.
He was in there 4 years because he wouldn't comply with your mandate that he cut his hair, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And y'all, you didn't challenge the proposition that the Rastafarian religion required him to leave his hair alone?
That's correct. We have not challenged that. The new policy, however, was enacted in June of 2019, which that timing is important because that you can't draw a through line from this litigation and Mr. Burke's claims, even assuming he's raised the grooming policy, to the department's changing of its policy. And I think that's a very important fact for the voluntary cessation analysis. Another important fact is that the department in this briefing and before this court has expressly disclaimed any intent of changing the policy back to the old one. And so I think that also sets this case and these circumstances apart from some of the court's precedent that counsel has cited this morning.
Where is that? I mean, you're saying it here today, but is that, you said it's in the briefing and in the record. Where is that?
Yes, Your Honor. It's in our brief at page 33 and 34.
So you are representing the applicant.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Judge Zia.
You're representing on behalf of the Commonwealth of Virginia that you do not intend to revert back to this policy, period?
But Your Honor, we're representing that defendants disclaim any intent of doing so.
Well, I mean, the language that's the principle of law that you have to abide by is it has to be absolutely clear that this allegedly wrongful behavior won't be repeated, won't be expected to recur. And you're suggesting that because of the sort of the time and effort it takes to reinstitute the policy and the representations in the record and in the brief, that's good enough? That satisfies that doctrine?
That is our position, Your Honor, but I think there's more. I think there are at least two other reasons that we can be assured that standard isn't met here. The first is that if you look at the history of the grooming policy, it has consistently become more lenient and allowed more hairstyles and offender conduct, not less. It's not becoming more restrictive. And that I think that history is important, and that history is important against the backdrop of the evolving legal landscape on these issues and the department's good faith attempt to comply with that. And on that note, this court is well aware of the Greenhill precedent that my friend on the other side has raised. And so to the extent that going back to the old policy would raise questions, at least under RLUIPA, I think that's another that potentially adverse precedent weighs in favor of the department here and weighs against the finding that there's any reason to believe the department is inclined to just flip a switch and go back to the old policy, particularly in light of the fact that Mr. Burke has not just been transferred out of the violator's housing unit, just him, as might be alleged to try to evade liability on this one litigation. The whole unit has been shut down and abolished. And so this isn't like one of those cases where it's easy enough to change something to try to wait out a lawsuit and then be able to go back overnight. But those just aren't the circumstances here, given the context of the department-wide policy and the evolution of that policy.
When you say the unit's been shut down and abolished, you mean that this unit Wallace Hills or something?
The violator's housing unit at Wallens Ridge. Yes, Your Honor. That when the grooming.
do they have a unit at some other prison like this?
There's no more violators housing unit, no, Your Honor. When the
nowhere in the system.
That's correct. When the grooming policy changed in June of 2019, a specific special housing unit for offenders of the policy is no longer part of the department's procedures. And you can see that in the addendum to our brief, which includes the new policy. And at the addendum at page 5, explains how it says all offenders that are in the grooming standards violators housing unit shall be transferred out to a suitable institution.
Ms. Sanders, you brought up the Greenhill case, and I know your first argument is that this claim regarding the grooming policy hasn't been properly preserved, but assuming we get past that and we think that it has been, you can see that under Greenhill, this policy as it existed before you changed it would in fact and did in fact impose a substantial burden on Mr. Burke's religion.
Your Honor, we think that question wasn't raised before the district court as discussed, and for that reason, we think if that is what the court is inclined to do, that a remand is appropriate to litigate that question below in the way that Greenhill did. We are not prepared to take a position on that here because it wasn't presented to the district court.
That's a bit problematic then, because if you say that, then it suggests to me that this claim is not moot if you're not willing to concede that point.
Well, Your Honor, we're willing to concede that Greenhill absolutely applies and is absolutely binding. I guess our point is that Greenhill was, you know, its own facts, and the district court at Greenhill remanded for further evaluation. And so we think that would be the appropriate course here if the court were to find that the grooming policy challenge had been raised.
All right, go ahead.
Thank you. I think it might be helpful, Your Honors, with the time we have left to discuss the claims that were presented below in our view. The RLUIPA and First Amendment claims as applied to the religious services items and holiday meals, the district court properly found that Mr. Burke had failed to show that these defendants imposed a substantial burden on his faith. The undisputed evidence shows that the defendants did not, in fact, deny Mr. Burke access to the items that he identified. Instead, he didn't submit the proper requests and comply with the proper policies. And I think it's important to note, Your Honors, that this is not just a matter of paperwork or needing to shuffle papers to get what Mr. Burke needs, but these policies are important and have important penological ends and justifications, and that they also work. I think if you look at, to take just one example, the list of approved religious items, which there's an example of the list at JA 277, you can see there are several items that are available. And if you look at JA 279, you can see where a new item, the Native American drum, was added, and it has the date that it was added. And so the idea that Mr. Burke was just getting stonewalled at every turn, it is inconsistent with the record because there is evidence in this record, and defendants have pointed to it, that there are processes in place for the purposes of preserving prison security, prison safety, inmate and staff safety that inmates need to comply with, and that those policies are meant to balance these goals and to make sure that VDOC can facilitate inmates' religious practice while also balancing these other important considerations. And so the question here is whether Mr. Burke was denied access to those claims, and in response, he points to a form that he submitted, which is at JA 40, is the religious services form, and VDOC's response is there's no hearing because all you need to do is enroll. And there's an enrollment form. There was an open enrollment period provided every quarter where you could change your enrollment or take yourself off of a list. And it's easy to understand, Your Honors, why in the context, the unique institutional context of a prison, that the prison officials would need to know who was signed up to go to which services And that asking Mr. Burke to complete that form is not a substantial burden. And at no point has Mr. Burke either presented evidence or pointed to evidence that he did submit the proper forms. I think that's important to note what he's arguing. My friend on the other side this morning said that suggested there was no form to request approval of a religious object. That is in the record at JA 426. We have no evidence that Mr. Burke did ever submit that. And so, while it can be, we understand the frustration in terms of trying to comply with these policies, but the evidence in the record shows that it was clear what Mr. Burke was needed to do to access these things, and that there's no evidence that he did. And on that record evidence, that there's no finding of a substantial burden on these claims. Turning to the equal protection piece of things, in the briefing and here this morning, counsel concedes that the grooming policy and the procedures for acquiring religious services and religious items applied to all offenders equally. They didn't single out any one group. They didn't single out any particular religion. They applied across the board to all offenders at the department. Counsel points to the form J274 that notes Rastafarians must follow DOC grooming standards. I'll just note, Your Honor, this form is, first of all, not part of the grooming policy. It's part of the religious, it's an attachment to the religious program's operating procedure. So it, of course, can't change or doesn't change the grooming policy. But more importantly, nothing about this form or the parenthetical to which counsel points notes that Rastafarians are the only ones who have to comply with the grooming policy. I think it's better understood as a note that by being on this list of religions that are approved to meet, that in no way excludes or exempts Rastafarians or any other religion from the otherwise generally applicable grooming policy that existed. If there are no further questions, Your Honor, appellees ask that this court affirm the district court's award of summary judgment as to both the free exercise claims and the equal protection claims. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Samuels. Mr. Hirawa?
Thank you, Your Honors. So I just want to make very clear that Mr. Burke most certainly raised his claim, and I want to read directly from his complaint. So if you look at the prayer for relief, which is on JA24, paragraph 3, Mr. Burke specifically requests, and I quote, a declaration that the acts and omissions of the Virginia Department of Corrections grooming policy of the operation of 86.4.1 as applied to plaintiff is in direct violation of his Rastafarian religious rights under the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act and the First Amendment Free Exercise Clause. So there he is expressly saying that this grooming policy violated his First Amendment and the LUPA rights. And then if you look at JA-283, again, Mr. Burke expressly argued that he was being punished for his religious practice. And I'll briefly quote, according to the 86.4.1 operating procedure, the violator's housing unit was designated to be at Wallens Ridge to discourage inmates from growing hair longer than the length allowed in the policy. This prohibited plaintiff from being employed in the kitchen, laundry services. Plaintiff grows his hair as necessary for his religion. Therefore, defendants are punishing the plaintiff for being religious. So Mr. Burke makes very clear that the operation of this policy and the creation of the VHU was punishment for him exercising his religious beliefs, which is most certainly a substantial burden. Now, what I think my friend today on the other side is telling of why this case isn't moot. So it's not enough for VDOC just to say that I think the words were disclaimed any intention. What this court's cases say is that you have to consider yourself prohibited from returning to this policy to establish mootness. And clearly that's not the case. Opposing counsel didn't say that VDOC recognizes that this policy places a substantial burden on Mr. Burke, so it would never go back to it, which is what would be needed to prove mootness. Because as this court said in Wall v. Wade, unsubstantiated appellate promises aside, we have previously held that when a defendant retains the authority and capacity to repeat an alleged harm, a plaintiff's case should not be dismissed as moot. So I think the Virginia Department of Corrections hasn't met its heavy burden of proving mootness here, and so therefore this court should address the RLUIPA claim as well. In terms of the religious items and kind of the singling out of Rastafarians by VDOT, I just think it is the least plausible reading of that document to say that this wasn't any kind of affixing upon Rastafarian inmates, this kind of specialized attention or kind of a specialized focus for this grooming policy. It just doesn't make sense given the fact that some Jewish sects have to grow their hair, some Native American religions require hair growth, some Muslim sects require growth of beards. There are so many religions that require hair growth or that could run afoul of the grooming policy. And so the fact that VDOC singles out Rastafarians just doesn't pass the smell test. And in fact, as Judge Kaiser said, the whole violator's housing unit, in his words, was designed to house people who could not cut their dreadlocks in violation of their religious beliefs. And that is specifically targeted towards Rastafarians. Regarding the request for religious services, I think it's really important to note at JA 345 that Mr. Burke was ineligible for group religious services by virtue of the fact that he was in the VHU. So it's simply not the case that he didn't fill out the right form. And in fact, Virginia VDOC's policies banned him from religious services. And I think it's telling the fact that Mr. Burke requested items over and over again through all different mechanisms and channels. And not once did a single person in the Virginia Department of Corrections tell Mr. Burke that you filled out the wrong form or that you need to fill out this form. Instead, he was in fact stonewalled. And I think given the breadth of other objects that VDOC has for other religions, I actually think that works against the prison in this instance, because it does show that efforts weren't made to allow Rastafarian inmates to practice their religion in the same way that other religions were allowed to practice.
Mr.
Hirawa,
yes,
Your Honor.
Can you tell us how many Rastafarians are in the Virginia prison system?
Your Honor, I don't know the exact number, but I do know based on the affidavits that Mr. Burke submitted just in the suit that there are at least seven in Wallen Bridge at the time he submitted his complaint with the attached affidavit. And I think the fact that the prison created a whole unit for Rastafarian inmates shows there was a substantial population, which really quickly going to another point. Virginia policy, its own policy states that if there are more than five people of a religion, then there's a presumption that they will be provided group services. And again, for whatever reason, the prison didn't abide by that policy when it came to Rastafarian inmates. So I think there's just too much on this record that goes to show that Rastafarians weren't allowed to fully practice their religion and in fact were punished through the use of solitary confinement for practicing their religion, that their religious practice was certainly burdened substantially about the prison's policies. And in fact, there's enough here to raise the Equal Protection Clause claim, such as summary judgment at this juncture was inappropriate. Now, trial may turn out something different, but I think at this stage, this court should reverse the district court. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Mr. Huala, you're court assigned, and I want to express the appreciation of our court, not just for you, but for the law students that worked with you and assisted you with this case.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I really appreciate it. Thank you. Judge Gregory be proud of you, sir.
I'm gonna quote that, Judge.
Madam Clerk.
This honorable court stands adjourned until this afternoon. God save the United States and this honorable court.